funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Do Americans really understand the energy crisis and its potential impact on our way of life? While it seems just about everybody these days has an opinion about energy consumption in this country, research by the nonpartisan policy analysis group Public Agenda reveals some serious gaps in our collective knowledge base. Fully a third of U.S. adults think solar energy contributes to global warming. 40% can't name a single fossil fuel, and more than half say they have never heard of cap-and-trade legislation pending in Congress. While my guest today worries that we cannot make smart decisions without a basic command of the facts, he does believe it is possible for all of us to get up to speed on the myths and realities of our energy consumption. Scott Biddle is executive director of publicagenda.org. His new book, written with Gene Johnson, is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. Scott, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me on, Chris.
So you started this with a survey to find out just how much we did and did not know about the energy situation. What surprised you?
Well, it surprised me that the knowledge levels were as low as they turned out to be. As you noted, 4 in 10 Americans can't name a fossil fuel, half can't name a renewable energy source. This is stuff one would hope people would learn in, like, middle school. But, of course, not everything we learn in middle school sticks, so maybe it's understandable on that level. But one of the things we have to deal with as a country is that we have choices to make. That's what it comes down to. What kind of choices we make for our electricity, what kind of choices we make for what we put in our cars. People can grapple with those choices, but you need some basic facts, and you need the options laid out with the pros and cons set out honestly so you can weigh the alternatives.
Yeah, one thing you do that is unique, and we do energy and the global warming issue a lot on this show, but you've made a point of mentioning the pros and cons of everything, including our use of oil.
Absolutely. You can't make an informed judgment unless you know what the downside is as well as the upside. And every energy option we have, regardless of what it is, does have a pro and it does have a con, and you've got to weigh it. It's just like anything else you do in life, whether you're buying insurance, buying a new car, you know, selecting a college to go to, we all know things have pros and cons. But so often, we get all our information from people who are trying to sell us something, who are trying to push a point of view. And it's hard for people to sort through all these conflicting demands.
The other important point here is that our problem really is twofold. We not only need to change a lot of our sources of power, but also to adapt to a growing global demand for energy.
Absolutely. And this, to me, is one of the most striking things about the energy challenge that most people haven't really heard of. They've heard about some of the other aspects of energy, you know, global warming, and they've heard about the problem of energy security, where we get our oil. But the really startling statistic is that world demand for energy is going to go up 40% over the next 20 years. Almost all of that is going to be driven by what's going on in China and India and other places in the developing world. China is having one of the great economic booms of modern history, which means that millions of people are living better lives. They're having more access to electricity. They're able to buy cars. This is all good stuff, but it means demand for energy is just going to skyrocket. We need to get both more energy and cleaner energy at the same time. That's the real challenge here.
Scott, do most Americans understand right now how much more energy we use per capita in this country than the rest of the world?
They certainly have a sense, yes, that most Americans use more energy than the rest of the world. There are some things that people do have a strong grasp on. They understand, for example, that we pay less for oil, you know, less for gasoline than most other countries. They understand we use more. On the other hand, they don't have a clear sense of what each form of energy does and some of the market implications of that.
There's also this reality that more than half of the energy in this country is consumed by business and industry. So all the light bulb changing and Prius driving that many of us are moving toward is important, but it's not going to be enough.
Absolutely. I think the environmental movement has done a really amazing job of driving home the message that small things add up to big things, and there are things you can do in your life to change the kind of energy you use. But at some point, you have to move on to the really big things. You have to start thinking about, okay, what do we use to get the electricity, regardless of what kind of light bulb we put in the socket? So we haven't done a very good job as a nation of moving on to those big picture decisions.
Now, it would seem like business and industry, of all things, would have a great interest in switching to plentiful and affordable fuel sources that is commensurate to the amount of energy they actually use. What gets in the way of that?
Well, several things. And there's a lot of interest in this in the business world. And certainly, if our energy mix is going to change, the business world has to play a huge part in changing it, because it's a free market system, and these things have to be economically viable. But the things that largely get in the way is, right now, renewable energy is just more expensive than fossil fuels. Unless we change that economic mix, people are going to go with the default setting, and the default setting is fossil fuels.
You do a really nice job here of laying out the different arguments made for and against additional government regulation in order to sort of shift our energy use to where it needs to be. Can you give us a little rundown of that, please?
Well, sure. I think on the one hand, you have the argument that less regulation is better, that in the end, it's business people and consumers who should be driving this. That it's a question, somebody has to find the supplies of energy, somebody has to get them to market, people have to make the consumer decisions about what they choose, and that in the long run, those are the soundest reasons for change. The argument for more regulation is that the free market doesn't always sum up the less tangible costs. It doesn't do a good job of factoring in the environmental costs of energy choices. And there may well have to be government priming the pump to get some of this stuff going and to make renewable energy competitive.
We've heard a lot over the past year or so about how the decline in the economy is also has also triggered a decline in energy use. On the other hand, which would seem like at least one small bright spot. On the other hand, though, I wonder if the economic crisis is also making it harder for businesses to even consider investing the initial capital required to switch fuel sources.
That's definitely true, and you see it in a number of areas, but generally speaking, there isn't as much investment money out there as there used to be. Generally speaking, with renewable energy, this is something you invest in when prices are higher, because then they're more competitive and you can make your money back. When demand for energy is low, you stick with what you've got and you stick with what's cheap. You see this a lot in the solar panel market. Solar panels are actually getting much cheaper. One of the problems is, though, one of the reasons they're getting cheaper is fewer people are investing in new energy sources. People don't need as much energy, so there isn't as much demand for them.
You say that we're only a few years away from solar being fully economically competitive as a source of energy. What do you expect to happen between now and, I think it's 2015, when you think it will be fully competitive?
Well, that's the federal government's goal. They are making progress toward it. There are some analysts who say it may not happen. Right now, the biggest factor in whether solar energy is competitive are how high electricity prices are and what kind of government incentives are being put behind it. This is why solar energy is taking off in California. Not only does the state of California put in incentives encouraging people to get solar panels, but Californians pay more than most Americans for electricity anyway, so it's more competitive. In the long run, the biggest thing will be how much the federal government puts behind solar energy in terms of tax credits and other ways of making it more viable, and whether or not production of the technology gets cheaper. And the price for producing a solar panel has come down. It's like every other kind of consumer electronics. You saw it in TVs and computers and all other kinds of consumer electronics. The more of them you make, the cheaper they get. But, of course, the demand has to be there to encourage you to make enough to make them viable.
Scott Biddle is my guest. He's executive director of publicagenda.org. His new book is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. I wonder, particularly with regard to solar, how important it is that people see their neighbors doing this. Is there sort of a peer pressure factor that will make this start to happen?
I think peer pressure does factor into it, but the bigger part of it is economics. And solar is a very good example of that. Another good example of that, of course, is hybrid cars and maybe in the next year or two, electric cars. If your friends start buying Priuses, then there's going to be pressure, you know, a kind of peer buzz to get a Prius, to get the more fuel-efficient car. On the other hand, you still have to go to the dealer. You still have to look at the sticker price. You still have to realize it's going to be $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 more expensive than, say, the Corolla sitting next to it in the lot. You have to decide how much the peer encouragement is worth to you.
Have you observed any shift in people who are willing to pay a little more? In other words, a Prius may not pay for itself in terms of fuel savings, but people are still wanting to make that choice. We should say Prius is not the only hybrid car out
Absolutely.
There. It's just
Absolutely.
Sort of shorthand.
Yes. I mean, we're just using that because I think it's, you know, the best known, but there's lots out there. I think there are encouraging signs there. In our energy learning curve survey that we talked about earlier, one of the things we found was that 70% of Americans say even when prices go down, we should still continue to worry about our energy use and should still try and conserve energy. That's a very encouraging sign. Unfortunately, one of the things over the past few decades is that we as Americans have taken the same attitude toward energy that Homer Simpson takes to just about everything, which is when prices are high, we go, dough, and we start doing very panicky things and demanding change, and we do change our habits. And then when prices drop again, we go, woohoo, and we forget everything we've learned. We've got to start getting off that roller coaster and start thinking in the long term and making long-term decisions.
Let's talk for a minute about plug-in electric vehicles. These sound like a really green choice. However, they're still powered by electricity, which is often sourced by fossil fuel.
Well, absolutely. You are getting cars off oil if you do that, so you are gaining something. But if you are then drawing your electricity from a coal plant, for example, you're still putting greenhouse gases in the air. Most of the analysis is that electric cars do produce less greenhouse gases, even when you factor the electricity in. The biggest challenge, again, is price. In the next year, we're going to see things like the Chevy Volt and the Nissan Leaf actually appear in showrooms and be available to folks. And there's a lot of buzz around them. But the sticker price is probably going to be about $40,000 for a four-door sedan. And with government incentives, maybe you'll get that down to like 32, 33, you know, and take your tax credit or your rebate, which is good, but it's still more expensive than a conventional car. That's going to be the big challenge.
Scott Biddle is with us. He's executive director of publicagenda.org. His new book is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. You're welcome to join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can get to us via email. The address is think@kera.org. Back in a minute.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Scott Biddle. He is executive director of publicagenda.org. His new book is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can give us a call now at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Scott, we currently import about 60% of our oil, which almost everybody agrees is too much. But assuming it were even possible, are there also potential drawbacks to complete energy independence?
Absolutely. And one of the biggest ones is it's probably not achievable. If you look at it historically, the last time the United States was able to cover all its own energy needs was the year Sputnik was launched and Elvis got his draft notice, 1957. If this was easy to solve, it would have been solved by now. But there are other factors too. Our biggest suppliers of oil are Canada and Mexico, not countries that we have a lot of beefs with on the whole.
Yeah, we tend to overestimate the influence of Middle East oil on the supply.
We certainly do. And Middle East oil is significant. It will continue to be significant because in the long run, that's where the reserves are. But again, actually not our biggest suppliers. And the other thing is, it might well be more expensive. Oil is sold on international commodities markets. And that usually produces the best price for everybody. Trying to be energy independent might actually raise prices because you're having less competition.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go to Laura J. in Fort Worth. Hi, Laura J.
Hi. Yes, I've been enjoying your program.
Thank you.
And as I was listening, I'm just inspired to call because actually I just finished reading this pamphlet on, you know, what you can do in terms of your attic. And I'm reading out these four choices, you know, the radiant bearer and the insulation. And I'm thinking, see, this is what I need is more specific information as to what I could do, you know, an hour from now, tomorrow. The last time I heard a show like this, got a couple of good tips, you know, taking your cell phone out, using the LED lights for Christmas lights. The light bulbs last a long time. And I love those things. And although it's great to hear in terms of the whole like macrocosm that you guys are talking about, I still need to know what I can do in the next 6 months.
Thanks so much for your call. I'm sure Scott has some ideas for you.
Thank you.
Well, there are lots of things you can do in the next 6 months. And actually, the Federal Department of Energy website has a lot of really great suggestions. Insulating, weather stripping, changing your light bulbs, using the kind of power strips that don't suck electricity when things are not, you know, that know when your appliances are turned off, and cut back on your electricity use. All very useful things, all very important things. What I would argue is that we do need to move on to the big next steps. And the big next steps are these fundamental questions about what kind of cars we drive and what kind of power plants we build going forward. And if we can do all the little things, and they will make a difference, but we still need to do the big things, and the big things are what make the big difference.
You mentioned power plants. We've talked a lot in Texas about coal-fired plants, but I want to talk for a minute about nuclear. It's been decades since we put a new nuclear power plant online in this country, and even if today people decided it were a good idea, it would be years before it were up and functioning. Do we need to reconsider the value of nuclear in terms of providing at least energy that does not contribute to global climate change?
Well, one of the things we're about in the book is laying out options for people so they can make up their own minds. We're not advocating for any particular kind of source. But I think it's very intriguing that nuclear power is back on the table in the United States in a way that it hasn't been for a very long time. The pros and cons of nuclear are pretty clear. It doesn't produce greenhouse gases. Once you have it up and running, the energy is pretty cheap. and it's something we know how to do technologically. The downsides are they do take a long time to build, partly because of just construction, partly because of the regulation that needs to be there. The last nuclear plant we got online in the United States took 23 years to go from initial inception to actually producing electricity. They're expensive up front. They're a big investment up front. And the biggest drawback of all is, what do we do with the waste material? And we don't have a good answer for that yet. There was talk of a big federal repository at Yucca Mountain. That is not going to happen, I think the Obama administration has admitted. And it's hard to deal with something that's going to be dangerous for 10,000 years. Just to put that in perspective, 10,000 years ago, human beings were living in nomadic tribes still trying to domesticate animals. So putting up a no trespassing sign and a chain link fence is not going to do it. It takes a pretty sophisticated solution.
And it is possible that we're getting ourselves into something that we can't even imagine the repercussions at this stage in human development.
Yes, that's absolutely an issue. On the other hand, you know, the French just said, we're going for it. And they get 80% of their electricity from nuclear power now. It's actually pretty popular in France.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Garland and speak with James. Hi, James.
Hi. I was wondering if the author had looked at the space-based solar system Japan is in the process of constructing / testing. They plan to have this online by 2030, and it's a 1-gigawatt system, which is equivalent to a medium-sized atomic power plant, and their production cost is 8 cents per kilowatt hour. And in reference, the average cost of residential electricity in the U.S. last year was 12 cents. So it seems to me in the long run that space-based solar is the answer.
Thanks for your call.
Isn't that a really intriguing idea? I mean, they are certainly thinking big, although I have trouble getting past the fact that I think that was a plot of a James Bond movie at some point where the villain had a solar thing in orbit. But that's just me. I watch too many movies. I think one of the things that we need to keep in mind is there are a lot of really amazing technological solutions that are possible out there, and that's one of them. And maybe it's a game changer. But if we're talking about meeting the electricity demand that's going to come up over the next 20 years, we need to start now, and we need to start with what's working out of the box now. I mean, you can't say to China, which is undergoing this huge boom, wait until something like the space-based solar panels are available. They're going to say, no, we have demand now. What are we going to build now? And another key factor is, when the power plants we build now, they stay in service for 30, 40 years easily. So we have to live with the decisions we make now for a very long time. I'd love to see a technological game changer, but we also have to work with what we've got in hand.
You know, Scott, one of the roadblocks that seems to present itself over and over, even among people who agree that we need to make some changes and want to move forward, is the fact that no one's quite sure which kind of technology will ultimately be the primary one. And maybe it's a matter of not thinking of a primary technology, but recognizing that we need to do this from a variety of angles. But how do we get past that kind of thinking, people's hesitation to invest large amounts of time and money into something that might not turn out to be the next wave?
Well, and I think part of this is, as a society, thinking through where we want to place our bets. And some countries have decided where to place their bets. Denmark, you know, decided to place its bet on wind power, and they've gone into it in a big way, for example. A lot of people say we should place our bet on clean coal, which is technologically possible, but right now only exists as a few demonstration projects. I think we have to think about what are the best bets, and we have to weigh these kinds of pros and cons. And as you say, we may not be able to say we have one answer and we're putting everything behind it. we may need to pursue a lot of different solutions. And when you look at which kinds of solutions are available now that can produce a lot of power, it's actually a pretty short list.
Scott Biddle is my guest. His new book is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. We'll go next on the phones at 1-800-933-5372 to Chris in Dallas. Hi, Chris.
Yes.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, one of the things I don't hear much about, but I know is supposed to be a very clean source of energy and quite plentiful, is geothermal, and I just don't really hear that that much press on it, and I was just wondering if you can explain what's up with that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, geothermal is getting more attention. A lot of people like Chevron and Google are investing more in geothermal, and Al Gore is very big on geothermal. It has a lot of potential because it doesn't produce much in the way of greenhouse gases. It's an inexhaustible supply. As long as the Earth the core of the Earth stays hot, you're in business. Big challenges. It hasn't gotten a lot of investment money lately. The Obama administration has decided to put more money into it. The other is moving on to the next level of technology. Traditionally, geothermal works when you basically find a hot spring and you drive a pipe down and you tap the hot water and you use it to drive your turbine. There's a newer technology called enhanced geothermal, where you pump water down. It heats up in the Earth, under the Earth's surface, and you pump it back up. This could be huge because you could do it anywhere. But it's just suffered a big setback. There was a demonstration project in Switzerland that's been accused of causing earthquakes because of the process used, and it's been shut down. There was another project in California modeled on that one, which has also been shut down for reasons that have not been entirely clear, but a lot of people in Northern California, for understandable reasons, were worried about anything that might encourage earthquakes.
They've got enough problems.
They've got enough problems that, you know, I can forgive them for being worried about earthquakes. It's not unusual. So that's where that's the latest on geothermal. Very promising. It's just, these demonstration projects have just hit a roadblock, and it's not clear how the technology gets past it.
Let's talk a little bit about biofuels. We hear a lot about the promise of ethanol, but there are also concerns about how we can understand its impact on the environment and on the global food supply.
Yes, this is one of the big things last year when global food prices, as well as global energy prices, skyrocketed. And a lot of countries in the developing world said this was because a lot of the big food-producing countries, including the United States, were using huge amounts of corn and sugar to produce ethanol. And as a benchmark, the United States right now devotes about a quarter of its corn crop to ethanol, which makes up about 5% of our total liquid fuel supply. The challenge is, if you start thinking about that, like one of those word problems they gave you in middle school, if it takes a quarter of our corn crop to produce 5% of our liquid fuel, how much would it take to produce 20% of our liquid fuel? And the answer is all of it.
So it's hard to scale.
It's hard to scale. The Brazilians have done very well with this. Of course, they use sugar for ethanol rather than corn because that's what they've got. And anyone who remembers loading up on breakfast cereal as a child and watching cartoons knows that sugar has a lot more energy value than corn. So they've been successful with that. But again, it may not scale properly. And there's a question of, you know, now food and fuel may be competing for the available land. This is why the real promise of biofuels may lie with things like switchgrass, which is a kind of plant that can be used for ethanol, but people don't eat it.
What about the use of garbage to create energy?
Another thing where there are some very interesting demonstration projects going on, has a lot of potential, but again, still in the demonstration level. People are working to take it to scale, but it's pretty much still in the prototype stage now.
We'll go back to the phones now at 800-933-5372. Richard in Dallas is on the line. Hello, Richard.
Hello. Great. I can't wait to read the book. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Welcome.
I want to just maybe, I'm not trying to throw a monkey wrench in there, but less about the technology and maybe I seem to be missing the overall larger conversation about unchecked global population as being almost the obstacle to the cure. I'm not sure, even with green technologies, that the planet could continue to be consumed by more than 7 billion people. We're, you know, have no regulations largely about how to supply electricity and what sorts of fuels are better for the environment. Nonetheless, we can't really sustain 7 billion now, and we're talking about Asia, along with unchecked growth, especially industrial growth across Europe and the United States. How about a conversation larger than just about our backyard about unchecked growth in general?
What do you think about that, Scott?
Well, if you're looking at climate change, if you're looking at the production of greenhouse gases, one of the best ways of thinking about it is there are three factors that go into how much carbon dioxide a country produces or the world produces. One is population growth. The more people you have, the more energy they use. Logical. Another is economic growth. More businesses open up, the more a country's economies expand, the more energy it uses. Again, logical. The third one is what they call carbon intensity, which is how much greenhouse gas you put out per unit of GDP.
Let me have you stop right there, and
Sure. You
can explain why those things all matter
and
how they play into this in just a moment. We'll take a quick break now and return with Scott Biddle after the break. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Executive Director of Public Agenda, Scott Biddle. His new book is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. You can join the conversation by sending email to think@kera.org or calling us at 1-800-933-5372. So we left off before the break, Scott. You were telling us that the three things that we really need to think about here are the size of the population, the growth in energy use by each individual within that population, and the carbon intensity of the energy sources that we choose.
Yes, and I was just plowing ahead there. So, but basically, the way to get ahead on greenhouse gas emissions is that your improvements in energy efficiency, energy intensity, have to stay ahead of your economic growth and your population growth. This is the challenge facing the Chinese. Their population is expanding. Their economy is booming. So they have to do a lot to stay ahead of that and reduce their greenhouse gases. There are some other examples of countries that have cut their greenhouse gases really dramatically, but nobody wants to follow their example. If you look since 1990, Ukraine has cut its greenhouse gases by like 45%. Latvia cut it by 70%. But the main reason for that was the fall of the Soviet Union. Their economies tanked. All these old, inefficient, polluting plants they had shut down. And in some cases, these countries actually even lost population because people moved out to find jobs. So that was great for their green for cutting their greenhouse gas emissions, but you'd kind of have to be Pollyanna on antidepressants to think that's the best strategy for approaching the problem. If you do look at it globally, there's this. I mean, the gentleman mentioned the our world population ending, you know, heading for 7 billion. The statistic that always leaps out at me is, of that 7 billion, there are about 1.5 billion now who have access to the Internet, and 1.5 billion who don't even have electricity. They get their energy from what, you know, wood they can throw in a fire. And over the next 20 years, a lot of those folks are going to get electricity as their countries develop. This is a good thing. These are, you know, our energy crisis is partly the problems of dealing with the fact that people are living better.
We have an email here from Annie who writes, growing up in New England, we had to have a backup source to our wood stove. I'm wondering why at some point we don't require new home construction to have an alternative energy source, wind, solar, geothermal, as the main source of energy with the electrical grid as a backup.
Well, and there are some, there are a lot of interesting initiatives on building better, greener buildings. There's a lot of new rules in various states and talk at the federal level of basically making Energy Star requirements apply to new buildings and new homes so they are more efficient, that they can get use energy more efficiently and be greener, which is great. We do have to keep in mind that most of us don't move into new houses. We buy existing houses. And there are 78 million dwelling units already out there in the United States where most of us live. So the problem of conversion and upgrading what we have is even bigger and maybe more important than what we do with the new buildings.
Is it feasible to look at regulating the size of construction for personal homes and perhaps putting a surtax on something that is beyond a certain number of square feet? Or is that something you think that Americans would just bristle against and never stand for?
Well, it's going to be a tough sell in an election year, I think. But I think this is one of the fundamental trade-offs that we as a society are going to have to look at. One of the things is, and lots of people are questioning this, is sprawl a good thing? You know, does our kind of spread-out American lifestyle inherently mean we're inefficient and we use too much energy? Worth debating. I think it's something we have to, you know, we as a society have to think about. There's pros and cons to that, but I think it's okay to talk about it. And the other thing is whether or not we need to make fossil fuels more expensive in order that renewable energy and clean energy has a chance to compete. This is a fundamental economic decision, and the American people need to be part of that debate, because unless they buy into these changes, they're not going to happen. You can't force these things down people's throats. They have to accept that this is a good idea and that they're willing to do it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Glenn in Arlington. Hello, Glenn.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
I wanted to comment about the biofuel issue. My brother John farms, raises cattle, and he raises corn. Some of his corn, no doubt, goes for ethanol production. He has remarked to me that he's frustrated with the discussions he hears about it, because there is one factor that seems to be overlooked, and that is that the byproduct from ethanol production is cattle feed, and it is almost as efficient as the corn would have been before it was used for producing the ethanol.
So, in other words, you can still derive cattle feed after you've made ethanol.
You can still derive cattle feed from it after the ethanol has been produced.
Is that something we're paying enough attention to, Scott?
Well, I think one of the things that makes this so complicated, the energy issue so complicated, is there are so many ramifications and so many ways these things play out. It isn't as if, you know, you buy your hybrid car or you change your light bulbs and everything else stays the same. All these other parts of the economy and parts of the energy mix get touched, and it's often very hard to figure out where we're coming ahead and where we're not. So I think that's an interesting angle to the issue.
How different will the economy look, or can we even predict that, when we have moved to an entirely sustainable system of energy production?
Well, it's going to take a long time, and there are going to be transition issues. If we start moving away from fossil fuels, then, you know, you can assume that we're going to have fewer jobs in coal mining and oil refineries and those kinds of jobs, but maybe more jobs in terms of installing wind turbines and solar panels and retrofitting buildings and that sort of thing. I mean, this is the green jobs concept that people talk so much about. And I think it's vital that we have a transition plan. We haven't done so well in this country in terms of helping people when the economy transitions. You know, I think a lot of things we've seen as the economy has transitioned, you know, away from manufacturing jobs to service jobs, for example, it's been very wrenching for people. And we need to think about, as a society, how to make this kind of transition less wrenching and make sure we bring everybody along.
Let's go next on the line to Sam in Bedford. Hello, Sam.
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi.
Nice to be part of it. Now, the thing is that you need to wake up and smell the coffee. Over the period of 60 years, we've been under the overprivileged impression that oil from Middle East will keep coming on. And he mentioned, your guest mentioned, that we import, our biggest exporters are Canada and Mexico. Now, we are victim of our own demagogy and hypocrisy. For example, downtown, how many metroplexes have a downtown all over America? They have lights on every day. All those metropolises that can use miniature light, why we can use miniature light and use all the high-rises, skyscraper, the huge light, and that's a big part of saving. On top of that, this gentleman, your guest, have you seen a documentary movie called House of Al Saud?
I haven't seen that.
No,
actually.
Okay.
He has seen or not?
He has not seen it. Can you just move really quickly to your final point, Sam? Thank you so much for your call.
Okay. We have negotiated with them more than 60 years ago that you keep giving us cheap oil and we will take care of your security. Now, we need to wake up. How long we can depend on foreign oil? Why can't we drill offshore Gulf of Mexico or eastern, western part of Florida or Pacific Ocean? Why we have this party politics and all this demagogy and hypocrisy?
Thanks for your call. Yeah, Scott, are we looking intensively enough at remaining sources of domestic oil?
Well, there's certainly more oil to be had in North America and worldwide. I think one of the things we're going to have to think about, though, is the oil is getting harder to find. We would have to go to places up in the Arctic Circle. We're going to have to go to deep water wells that are more than 1,000 feet down. And if you look at it globally, North America has about 5% of the world's remaining oil reserves. The Middle East has 60%. So the big picture trend is not in our favor on that point. And the other thing is, as we talked about earlier, is demand. We're going to be competing for the oil that's out there with a lot more countries and a lot more people. And that's going to have to change our strategy over the long term.
How close are we to reaching the apex of energy efficiency for the kinds of things that we already use right now?
Oh, I think we've got a long ways to go. There's a lot more that can be done and a lot more that we're going to have to do. One of the things, of course, is that if prices remain low, there's not that much incentive to get more efficient. When prices get higher, then that spurs a lot of creativity.
Can you talk for a minute about your primary reasons for optimism when you take on a subject as complicated and as important as this one?
Well, I always have reason for optimism, but on this issue in particular, I think there are signs that people are grappling with this issue, that they know the old ways of the past can't remain. And the other is that, you know, our organization does citizen engagement. We spend our time working to bring communities together and help folks deal with public issues. And people have such great capacity for doing that, for weighing choices, for making decisions. This is something that often gets obscured by the tone of our political debate in Washington. But actually, people are really good at thinking through problems if you give them a chance and some basic information. And that's what we've tried to do here.
I'm proud to say that our audience does tend to be really well informed about issues of sustainability and energy consumption and use. But there are always those conversations with members of the family or people down the street who are not as well informed. Beyond handing out copies of your book, are there suggestions that you have for talking to people who may be in that group that thinks that solar energy contributes to global warming and doesn't fully understand it, but still needs to be informed and engage in this conversation?
Well, if you want to get people to the basics, obviously there's our website, publicagenda.org, and the Energy Information Administration, the branch of the Department of Energy that gathers statistics and on this, does a really great job of laying out the basics. So there's a lot of information out there. You know, and there's a lot of links you can share on Facebook and send around to your friends. You know, but those, I think, would be the best starting points. And we actually put on our website, in the Who Turned Out the Lights section, an appendix of a lot of good resources you can go to. And you can find that at whoturnedoutthelights.org.
Did you also find a lot of scary sources of misinformation in the course of this research?
Oh, there's plenty out there. I mean, but this is what makes it so confusing for people, in that there are a lot of people who are basically trying to sell a point of view or make their point, and there's nothing wrong with that inherently, but it's very hard to sort through all the conflicting opinions and get to the facts. But it is possible. It can be done.
Scott Biddle is executive director of publicagenda.org. His new book, written with Gene Johnson, is called Who Turned Out the Lights? Your Guided Tour to the Energy Crisis. Scott, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.